you can't label Claire. And I think that makes him so interesting. He was studying cubism, expressionism, constructivism, all of it, but he did something on his own, and he was not a dogmatic artist. My name is Fabienne Egelhöfer, and I'm the chief curator at the Zentrum Paukle in Bern, Switzerland.
My name is Anja Guttenberger, and this is my podcast, Bauhaus Faces. Welcome back to a new episode of Bauhaus Faces. I'm Anja, your host. In today's episode, you will hear the first result of my tour to Switzerland back in May, when I visited several experts and heirs. One of my stops was at Zentrum Paukle in Bern to interview Fabienne Egelhöfer, whom you've just heard in the introduction. Paukle created so much art during his lifetime. In his last year of life alone, 1,253 works. But his career had started much earlier than with his appointment as Bauhaus master. He had lived a full life before. In the beginning, becoming a musician, like his parents and his wife Lily, was even in the game. But Claire decided that all good music had already been written, and so he chose to become a painter. But music would always be a big part of his art and private life. While studying at the Academy of Fine Arts in Munich, Claire felt that he would never be able to learn painting. A travel to Tunisia in 1914 would become pivotal for Claire's paintings. That's at least what he wrote. In Tunis, he discovered the color, he said, and thus now finally is a painter. When Gropius asked Paukle to come teach at the Bauhaus in 1920, the school was still very young and struggling to become what it is known for today. Vasily Kandinsky, with whom Claire had earlier been part of the Blaue Reiter art group, was also appointed, and the two of them were the real magnets to attract young students to the Bauhaus. Paukle, though, was inexperienced as a teacher and had to find his own ways first, and never had enough time for his own art, a crucial point in deciding to leave the Bauhaus after 10 years. In the writings of many Bauhauslers, especially those of the Bauhaus weavers, Claire is often portrayed as a mentor, capable of painting with both hands at the same time, but also as someone whose teaching the students only understood much later, after their time at the Bauhaus. Before I start spoiling everything beforehand, we should get started now. Just a little side note, in this podcast episode, I wanted to try something new, so I published the whole conversation between Fabienne and me. Let me know if you like this format more or the same as the last episodes. You can write me a message via the podcast homepage, bauhausfaces.com, via Instagram, there I am, at bauhausfacespodcast, or an email to bauhausfaces@gmail.com. Oh yes, and don't forget to tell everyone you know about Bauhaus Faces and rate the show with 5 stars on Spotify or Apple Podcast. Thank you so much. So, let's now dive into a new episode of Bauhaus Faces and shine a light on Paukle.
He was born in München-Buchse, which is a small village close to Bern, but then moved to the city when he was a child. His father was a music teacher. His mother was a singer, so music was very important in the household. And he had a sister, Mathilde. I think his aunt motivated him to do drawings when he was a child. So he went to school here. He was not a very good student at the end. And then he was hesitating if he should become a musician or an artist. But then he thought, okay, if I become a musician, he was a very good violin player. He thought, well, I cannot play what has already been composed. I can't become a composer because nobody can do better compositions than Bach or Mozart. So for him was clear, the geniuses, they already here, I can do something new. And then he decided to study art, and he went to Munich because at that time Munich and Paris were like the most important cities to study art at that time. So we talk about the beginning of the 20th century. And he went to Munich tried to get into the academy, art academy, but he was rejected because they told him he is not very good in drawing nudes. But how could a young boy, more or less, after school, you know, where does he get his models? So he went to a private school in Munich, Knirr School, and studied how to do life drawings. And then he tried again to get into the academy and was admitted. And he was studying with Franz Stuck, but only for one semester, because he realized, I don't learn anything new. They just teach me what has been taught the last 200 years. And he wanted to invent something new. So he stopped going to the academy. But he had a great life in Munich. He got to know his future wife, Lili Stumpf, who was a piano player. So they played together music, had fun, a lot of parties. But his parents, of course, he told him, well, if you don't study, you have to come back to Bern. We don't pay you having a nice life in Munich. So he returned to Bern in 1901 and made a trip to Italy, which many artists did, and was traveling around for a couple of weeks. But there too, he was kind of frustrated because he said, well, it's Renaissance, Baroque, but there is nothing new. So he came back to Bern and began kind of a self-education. So he went to the university and studied with the medicine student anatomy, because he realized, I actually, to reproduce what you see, to copy what you see, that's easy. You can learn it. So it's more interesting to know what's underneath our skin. What is the inner structure of the human body? Why we look the way we look? So there he already realized what's important is to study what is inside and not what you see. There comes his famous quote, Kunst gibt nicht das Sichtbare wieder, sondern macht sichtbar. So art does not reproduce what you see, but it makes visible, this very famous quote that he wrote in 1920. So he made this self-studies. He also discovered his children drawings, and he wrote to Lili, who stayed in Munich. Well, I discovered my children drawings in the attic of my parents' apartment. And I thought, wow, that's maybe something of the best I've ever done. Because it's like this primordial creation without academic approaches. And he really tried to find out what could he do? How could we invent something new?
Also in music, he said, everything great has been done. I don't need to do that anymore. And the same in art. What do you think was the trigger for that, that he was seeking for something new?
I think he just wanted to be an inventive artist, a creative artist who does something that has not been done before. Of course, he studied a lot of other artists that were before him. At the beginning, took some of the aspects here and there. And it continued like that. I mean, he was not a genius as every artist. He was studying what was happening around him. He went to Paris in 1912, discovered Cubism, and then also at the Bauhaus, of course, the constructive art was influenced their style. So he was taking up everything that he saw and then, but tried to do something on his own.
And do you think that the music that he'd done since a child, probably because of his parents both being musicians, did that have any influence on his painting? Can you see that in his paintings, in his earlier paintings, or also in the later painting?
I think it's mostly during the Bauhaus teaching where he realized that music could be a good example to explain to students how you can do something with a rhythm, with a melody, with the sounds. So his polyphonic watercolors from the Bauhaus period are very famous, where he really tried to put different layers of color together to get a new polyphonic image. So I think it's more in the sense of structure of music that he tried to translate into his art.
And I also read that he was interested in caricature and satire.
Yes.
Is that something that's worth mentioning?
Yes, at the beginning, because at the Central Park Claire, we have about 4,000 works and the whole archive. So everything that belonged to him is now in our archive. So we have also his school books. And since he was not very interested in the teaching, he made a lot of drawings in his school books, and they are so funny. It's a caricature of people that appear in the books, but also of fellow students or teachers, of course. So he was very good in drawing from the beginning. And that's something he continued when he was trying to become an artist. He was also applying to illustrate or publish some of his drawings in the satirical magazines in Germany without success. But he was really very good in observing people and also observing what was happening around him, politics. There are so many drawings where he was really commenting in a very ironic way on what was happening in the world and around him.
Hmm. When were the first steps into the avant-garde? Where did he meet other avant-garde artists, and how did that have to do with his own art? How did it influence him?
So in 1906, they married, Lily and Paul. Also, her parents were not very happy that he's marrying an artist that is not earning any money. But then he went to Munich again. They had a child, Felix. So he was mostly looking after the child, cooking, doing the household. So he was a very modern husband. And she was giving piano lessons to have enough money for their lives. But he continued drawing, working in the kitchen. He's explaining, like, with the brush, he's like stirring the soup with one end and then drawing and painting with the other end. And then his school friend, Louis Moyer, came to Munich, and he was also an artist, and he was a very outgoing person. So he got in touch with all the people, and then he got in touch with Vasily Kandinsky and introduced Claire to Vasily Kandinsky, who happened to live more or less next door in Munich in the same street. And then Claire got to know the whole gang around the Blaue Reiter, the Blue Rider, Kandinsky, Gabriele Münter, Werefkin, Franz Marc, Jawlensky. So all these artists, and they were searching the same he was searching for. What could we do new that is not academic? How can we go back to the roots or back to the beginning? It was this idea that there can be a beginning. So they were all looking at non-academic art, like folk art, children's art, non-European art. So their interest met, and they then asked him also to exhibit with them at the second exhibition of the Blaue Reiter in 1913, I guess. That's how he got into the network of avant-garde art. And it was very important to him. They also told him, well, if you go to Paris in 1912, you have to meet this artist and Robert Delaunay. So he went to his studio. And I think it's like today, it's very important for artists to get into a network. You can be the best artist, but if you just at home and do the best art and nobody sees it, it's very difficult.
It's not worth anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then comes the Great War around. What happens during the Great War?
The First World War had two sides for Claire. One side was, of course, that all his friends, a lot of them were Russians. They had to leave Germany because they belonged to the enemy's nation. So this whole scene in Munich was falling apart. Some of the artists were very enthusiastic about the war, like Franz Marc. They were going into the war. They died very soon. And the same day he received a telegram about the death of Franz Marc, he received a call that he has to go into the war as a soldier. He was German. He was born in Switzerland, but his father was German. And at that time, children got the nationality of the parents. So that was in 1916. So he was 37 years old. Mm-hmm. And he went to war. He always said, I don't think the war is a solution for our situation. We have to find other minds to reorganize society. So he was quite lucky because he hadn't really go to the front. So he was stationed at an airport in the accountants department. So he had time to continue working. And of course, what happened around him influenced also his work. At the one side, we have a lot of drawings where he's really commenting on the war. But there are also a lot of abstract, colorful works he made at that time because they were also selling better. He was interested in abstraction. That happened before in 1914 when he went this famous trip to Tunisia that he made with Louis Moyet and Macke. When he came back to Switzerland after this trip to stop in Switzerland, the First World War broke out. But in Tunisia, he continued his exploration of abstraction and also after Tunisia. And during the war in these airports, the airplanes at that time, they were covered with some fabric. So that was when he started to use fabric, for instance. He was starting to work on fabric and then gluing these pieces on a cardboard. But for him, this life of a soldier, in many letters, he describes it to his wife with a very ironic, almost cynical tone that he is like part of a theater. That's how he could keep it psychologically at distance, what was happening during the war. So he was lucky that he could continue to make new works, to develop his art. And he was one of the only artists that were left of the avant-garde in Germany. So he had the possibility by the end of the war to show his artworks. He had the first contracts with art dealers. 1920, the first monographic publications were coming up, three publications. So he was kind of the hero of the avant-garde, a little bit thanks to the war, which sounds horrible, but it's the way it is, and could establish himself as an avant-garde artist by the end of the First World War.
Let's talk a little bit about this Tunis trip. I think that's kind of pivotal in his, or yeah, as you said, it's the breakthrough as an avant-garde artist, as an abstract artist. So maybe you could tell me some more about how it came to this point that he went with Macke and Moyet to Tunis, how they were deciding on that and what they saw and how that influenced. Perhaps you could pick one or two of his images and describe it a little bit more in detail where you could see the parallels or inspirational points of his Tunis trip.
So Louis Moyet had been to Tunisia already a couple of times before that, and Klee kind of was pushing him to go together again to Tunisia. Louis Moyet was not so fond of it, but Macke, who was also living at the time in Thun, which is close to Bern, they met there. And then they said, okay, let's do it. Let's go together to Tunisia. It was in April 1914. And they went there. Louis Moyet knew a Swiss, I think he was a doctor, who lived there, so they could stay with him. They were traveling around, and Klee is describing his impressions in his diary. But we have to be careful with his diaries because he was editing his diaries afterwards. In a letter to his wife, he says, I'm editing my diaries. Maybe sometime they will be published. So he kind of wrote how he became an artist in his diary. And there he says, I'm in Tunisia and with the light. And then the color took obsession of me and I became a painter.
Very dramatic.
Very dramatic. So if we look what he made before he went to Tunisia, there are a lot of beautiful watercolors that are already also abstracted. So, yeah, it's kind of also a myth that he was trying to convey. But I'm sure that the lights, the colors in these lights, you can see it in his watercolors. And also the urban structures, the architecture, which is not Like in Europe, you have a lot of houses that look more like squares or cubes, and that helped him to become more and more abstract. And yeah, there are watercolors. One is for den Toren von Kairouan, Before the Gates of Kairouan, a watercolor he made there. And you can see on the right and the left side, like blank strips. That's where the elastic was holding the paper on the cardboard, because he was drawing outside and there was some wind. And these watercolors, some still have some anecdotal aspects, like you can see a camel or people, but they also have this kind of abstract squares that relates to the houses, and the colors are very light, rose, yellow, violet. So you can see this bright light that was really influencing him.
Hmm. When and why did Paul Klee become part of the Bauhaus experiment then?
As I said, after the First World War, he was a famous avant-garde artist. And since at the Bauhaus, they were trying to attract avant-garde artists, it was Gropius who wrote him in 1919 if he wanted to come to the Bauhaus. And Klee was already searching for a position as a professor, because that would allow him to have a regular income. And he wanted to assume his position of a man to be able to look after the family. So he said, yes, that sounds very interesting to me. And it was in December 1920 that Gropius appointed him as a teacher. So in May 1921, he began with his teaching. But as you know, at the Bauhaus, at that time, at the beginning, the curriculum was not very fixed or set. So he was like, okay, what should I do? Klee has only briefly taught before, but he was not a trained teacher, a bad pedagogue. So he actually had no idea what he should teach. So the first thing he made was a Kompositionspraktikum, composition practicum, kind of. That's where the student came with their works, and he showed some of his works, and they were talking about composition. And then in November 1921, he gave his first regular semester. And we have his teaching notes from the first semesters. They are in the book, with the title Paul Klee, Beiträge zur bildnerischen Formlehre, so contributions to the pictorial theory of form. And he started to explain to the students how a form becomes. He explained, you have a point. If a point is moving, you have a line. When a line is moving, you get a surface. And the surface is moving, you get the volume. But he soon realized that it's too abstract. They don't really understand what he wanted to teach. So at the beginning, he gave a lot of examples of nature. He said, like, look, it's like in nature. You have a seed. If a seed gets to move, you have the stem, then the leaves, and then the blossoms. Or also how a human body works. So he gave a lot of examples to explain to them what's the importance, how a form becomes.
I just remember I was recording a podcast with another art historian about Fritz Kur, and he was studying in Paul Klee's class. In the estate of Fritz Kur, there is this drawing of a plant, and you can see the seed and the roots and how it becomes a flower. That's exactly what we were just describing.
Yeah.
That was just like coming to my mind that it totally makes sense, because I was wondering, why would he paint that?
He also gave them the task, draw different kind of leaves, but not out of fantasy. But if the leaf vein, for instance, is stronger, then it's longer. Or if they have all the same strings, then the leaf at the end has a very regular shape. If the leaf veins have different kind of energy, the leaf form is much more irregular. So he was really trying to explain them the passes how to form something. And later on, it became much more abstract when he had more experience in teaching. You can see that in his teaching notes. He teaches theory of form, which was part of the Grundlehre, kind of the mandatory course that students had to take after the preliminary course, which was in the first semester. And like Kandinsky, who was teaching more color, Clay was really focusing on form. So at the beginning, he really prepared his teaching notes, every word. And he even wrote to his wife after one of the first classes he gave. It went very well. I was very well prepared to the last word, so I didn't say something irresponsible. So that shows how insecure he was when teaching. And also the students that were in his classes, they described that he entered the room with his back to the students and started to read from his book and making drawings on the wall. And also most of the students say, actually, I did not really know what he wanted to teach us. It's only later that I understood what he wanted to teach us. And it was the same for me when I started to study his teaching notes. We have this book, but we also have 3,900 teaching notes. They were in our ward storage in boxes. And at a certain point, I thought, okay, somebody has to have a look at them and try to organize them. And so it took me a couple of years to understand what he really wanted to teach. But I think now I understood it. It was really about the process, about how a form becomes. Therefore, movement, dynamic is very important. He also talks about the arrow in one of his classes, which is kind of funny because he says the arrow is a very easy symbol to express movement. You shouldn't use it. I use it in my art, but you shouldn't use it. So he always also taught them that they should not be focusing on a certain result. It's really the process that is forming the result.
Apropos, the arrow, my favorite painting by Paul Klee, it's Abfahrt der Schiffe.
Yeah,
I don't know if you know it, Departure of the Ships. I just love it because it just makes sense, you know?
Yeah.
The arrow points in one direction, and you know, the ship leaves in that direction, you know? It's so easy. And at the same time, it reminds me a lot of what my children drew when they were younger, not thinking about if it has to be pretty or what the teacher expected, but just to do something just for fun for themselves that really goes together.
Yeah.
But then the color, the background is quite dark.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You will see it. It's in our collection.
Is it?
There are two.
I just love it. It's so good because the colors are so bright against this dark background. It's just a masterpiece, I think. Yeah,
it's really a good painting.
Paul Klee also went to Dessau with the Bauhaus. So did his teaching with the new motto, Art and Technique in New Unity, did this change over the time as well, or did he stick to what he was teaching in Weimar?
It developed. Well, he was hesitating if he should go to Dessau. He was trying to find another job because it was a lot of teaching. And he was always complaining in letters to his wife or to his son, Felix, that he has not enough time for his own work. Because then he had life classes, drawing classes, he took over theoretical classes for the weaving workshop. So he had 8 to 10 hours classes that he was teaching, and it really became too much for him. I don't know if the evolution or change in his teaching had to do with Gropius' motto, or if it had to do that he was more experienced in teaching, that he didn't need all these examples from nature and how the human body works. But he was certainly teaching planimetric configuration. So it was very geometrical. We have mathematical books in his library, which is now here, where you can see that he was using examples from there. It becomes really totally concrete, geometrical. but he was sticking to the motto. So he was saying, for instance, a triangle. A triangle is not just here. It's a point and a line. And then the line is moving to the right and to the left. The triangle becomes. If this line or pendulum is freed of gravitation, it turns around the point and then you get the circle. So for him, even the basic elementary geometrical forms are not just here, but they become. And that's how he then explained how you can develop endless variations of geometrical form, but by a certain process. How to combine the forms, how they are moving into each other, etc., etc. So there are a lot of these geometrical drawings, and I always thought, I don't think he was teaching that. But when you look at the students' notes, which we compared all of them, you can see that he was really using them. And I think for a weaving class, that was very helpful because he said a whole surface, the composition, it has to have rhythm. It has to be lively. That's also a word he was using a lot, lebendige Gestaltung, a lively configuration. And I think that helped the weavers to think about how they could structure the surface in an interesting way.
You already mentioned those student notes that you also have in your archive here at Centrum Pölkli. Do you have maybe one or two examples for me of which students you've got those notes and what they've written down? Yeah. Because I know there are people like Lina Meyer Bergner, for example, mm-hmm. Annie Albers and so mm-hmm. on, who are deeply impressed until the end of their lives of Pölkli because he was able to paint with both hands at the same time, yeah. but also because what they taught them for their craft.
Well, Annie Albers is a special case because, as she says in interviews, she probably only had two or three classes with Pölkli. And if you look at her teaching notes, they are typoscripts. They must be copies of, don't remember whom, another student, because it's exactly the same. So they were copying, like students do today. They were copying the notes from other students when they were not in the classes. And she also says that at that time she did not really understand well what he was teaching. But of course, she admired Klee as an artist a lot. And then also later on when she began to teach, she also realized how interesting it was what Klee tried to teach to the students at the Bauhaus. Yeah, I can show you these notes, also compare them. Some of them are really identical to the drawings Klee made. And
so he probably drew it.
He drew it because there is like a big ruler somewhere in our archive that he probably used on the chalkboard. So yeah, I think he must have been drawing it and then the students were copying what he did. And we have most of the copies of students' notes that we gathered in the Bauhaus archives in Weimar and Berlin, just to compare and try to find out what was he teaching in a certain semester. And his teaching notes, he reused them. So there are a lot of edits because when he used them a second time, he knew, okay, that was not really working. They did not understand it. So I'm not going to repeat that, but maybe I give another example. So also his teaching was a process.
Let's talk about his pedagogical sketchbook. I think it was published as a Bauhaus book. Am I right?
Yes, his pedagogical sketchbook was published in 1925 as a Bauhaus book. The announcement was first pictorial mechanic. That's one of his chapters of his teaching notes. Because at a certain time, we think it was in 1928 that he made an index for his teaching notes. I think he wanted to make an order. We have this index and we try to order all the teaching notes according to this index, which is now in our online database. But the pedagogical sketchbook, there are some notes from the contributions to a theory of form. So from his very first lectures, classes he gave in Weimar. But there are also some sketches from lectures he gave later on that are from the first chapters as pictorial mechanics and principal order. Yeah. So it's a mix of his teaching classes. We also analyzed that. And I always think it's interesting how many people say how important this pictorial sketchbook was for other artists, because I think it's so abstract. If I didn't have the context of everything that he taught, I wouldn't understand it. But it seems to be very important for many artists that came afterwards.
So Paul Klee gave loads of new ideas to his students at the Bauhaus. And as you already mentioned, he was teaching long days. Did he have any time to paint himself during that time? And if yes, well, and how far did maybe the Bauhaus change his paintings?
Yeah, I mean, he was considered as this expressionist artist when he came to the Bauhaus, like Johannes Eaton and Kandinsky. And I think his art was freer. And with the years that he was teaching at the Bauhaus, I mean, Van Doesburg was there, tried to become a master, but he did not end up at the Bauhaus really, but he gave free classes in Weimar. And of course, Molinage, who came, who was very geometrical artist. Of course, it influenced his art. You can see the Bauhaus works he's famous for are these geometrical compositions with watercolors that are layered one color on the other. But at the same time, he did a lot of figurative drawings, but they are not so well known. But yeah, I mean, being more abstract, geometrical, there's a whole series of drawings he made in the 1931, 32. These only geometrical compositions, like almost like his teaching notes, planimetric compositions. I think, but that's my personal interpretation, he was not so inspired because he had to teach so much that his head was not really free to do something new. That's also why he wanted to leave the Bauhaus. And the funny story is in 1927, he went for a vacation in the south of France and he just didn't come back on time for the semester. And then the teachers were thinking, "Ooh, okay, what shall we do?" And Gropius, they sent him a telegram that he has to immediately come back. And he took his time, came back 2 weeks later. And in a letter to Gropius, Klee justified his absence. Maybe I can quote this one. He says, "I am first and foremost an actively productive artist, and I have dared dutifully to take on a difficult task as an educator. Difficult insofar as this post, like myself on occasion, represents a burden that can be balanced with my creative work only under certain conditions. These conditions are that the task of teaching itself be organized productively and that room be allowed for rest and relaxation in the form of a proportionately ample holiday. One that is fairly extensive." But it shows already in 1927 how much a burden teaching was for him. And 2 days later, he also wrote to Lily, "I'm trying to paint again, but regrettably, I must admit once again to a certain haste in my work, because time is not entirely mine. The Bauhaus no longer annoys me, but things are demanded of me whose fruitfulness is only very limited." The quarrels in the Bauhaus, all these discussions, he was not really interested in this, also a political how it should shift. And yeah, so that's why he was looking for another job.
But nevertheless, he stayed for quite a while, also when Gropius left the Bauhaus and many others with him. Then he still worked under the directorships of Hannes Meyer and Mies van der Rohe at the Bauhaus. Are there any reflections of Paul Klee about that?
He was already in his head, he was already far away. And at the end, I think he only had to give this free painting class, which Kandinsky and Klee started in 1929. Because the students also wanted to do art, even though the Bauhaus was not an art academy. I think that has to be said very clearly. Gestaltung, design was the focus. But nevertheless, Klemt Kandinsky gave these free painting classes where students could come and discuss about the artworks they were doing. And at the end, the last year before he left, he was mostly teaching only this class, yeah.
That's really interesting because I've just published a podcast about Hannes Meyer with a US-American art historian.
I listened to it.
She says that he wanted to take out the art and the equation, art and technology in your unity, which annoyed many people. The more it's surprising that they installed these free painting classes in 1929, but it was probably, you know, like giving sugar to the students to stay at the school.
Absolutely.
Because, of course, they were also coming for Vasily Kandinsky and Paul Klee and those big names, right? Mm-hmm. Those big artists.
Yeah.
Well, so when and why did Klee leave the Bauhaus?
He stayed 10 years. And then in April 1931, he was appointed by the Kunstakademie Düsseldorf, Art Academy in Düsseldorf, where he started in September 1931. So he went to Düsseldorf to teach at the Art Academy, where he did not have to give classes like at the Bauhaus, this design form classes. He could do his paintings and drawings and the students were doing and he could discuss with them. I think he gave some lectures, but it was not as much as it was at the Bauhaus. And that was a relief for him. So he really enjoyed to be in his studio and cooked in his studio in letters to Lily, who stayed in Dessau. He was writing what he was cooking. He was talking about the studio restaurant that he's running. And so he was a very good cook. And that was the theme. But of course, also the political situation. In a letter, he tells her, well, I don't know how things are evolving. Maybe soon I will be free and I can just paint, which maybe wouldn't be that bad. So he was sensing that the school is under pressure. And then he lost his job in 1933. And the political situation got more and more difficult. They were searching his house in Dessau, taking his belongings. And Lily and Paul then decided on Christmas 1933 to flee to Switzerland. And they had a lawyer who was taking care of their stuff to bring everything to Bern.
So let's circle a little bit back to Düsseldorf, to the Kunstakademie, to the Art Academy. Are there any teaching notes left from that time too?
We don't know, but we know some of the students went with him to Düsseldorf. And we have Petra Petitpierre, for instance. We have student notes from her. And I think also from other students. So we know that he was teaching some of the things that he taught at the Bauhaus. I don't remember exactly what it is.
Was just wondering if he was so meticulous about keeping his notes from this time as well, or if he was just enjoying to be an artist.
Yeah, he was reusing some of his teaching notes there.
Once they've reached Switzerland, where did they go and what did they do there, the Klees?
They came back to Bern, where Klee grew up. The first weeks they stayed at the house of his parents, were looking for an apartment, found one small apartment. So he was kind of back to the same situation he experienced during the First World War. His whole network fall apart. I mean, he was quite isolated in Switzerland. Culturally, there was not that much happening as had happened in Germany and France before. But nevertheless, he was very happy. He continued to work. The studio was in his living room because, of course, they did not have that much money.
They were in Switzerland and did the upheaval of the National Socialists in Germany, but also the fascists in Italy, two countries which are really close by. Did that affect his work artistically?
Yes. It already started in Düsseldorf in 1931. He began to have topics in his artworks that are kind of commenting on the atmosphere that became more and more oppressive. And in 1933, he made like a whole series of drawings, very untypical pencil drawings. The lines and the drawings, you can feel his anger. They are really very strong. Of course, the Klees never explicitly commenting something. It is really more the atmosphere. It's a lot about education, about children playing war, about people emigrating. And that's why these drawings are so timeless. So if you show them nowadays in a certain political context, people are like, oof, okay, that's actually the atmosphere we are living in. And I think generally that makes Klee so interesting. So he made a whole series in a, I think it was friends who were visiting him, and he mentioned that he was drawing the National Socialist Revolution. And it's 256 drawings. It's big, yeah. And after that, he made also more abstract brush drawings, kind of calligraphic, very reduced, but very poignant on the situation, the atmosphere that was reigning in Germany. And also afterwards, you have some of his works that were relating on other kings that were dictators, tyrants. Yeah.
He was considered a degenerate artist by the Nazis. Did it affect at all people to not collect him anymore at that time? Did it affect his financial situation?
Well, it was difficult for him to sell anyway, and to be a degenerate artist was not affecting the collectors who were collecting his artworks. But as a consequence, the artworks that have been in German museums, they were taken out of these collections, and he still had some works at German museums as loans, so he asked them back.
So what happened to those paintings that Paul Klee couldn't get back during the Nazi period? Where did they go, and did they all pop up after the Second World War again here and there? Or were there also paintings that were destroyed forever?
Few paintings disappear. So the artworks from the German museum that have been confiscated by the Nazis, and they wanted to make money out of it, so a lot of them were sold in auction. One of them was also in Switzerland. And some of his art dealers went to New York. Ibe Neumann, he went to New York earlier, already in the 1920s. Karl Niemdorf went to New York. And also Galka Scheier went to the U.S. And they tried to promote German art, because in New York at the time, it was the School of Paris, was the European avant-garde, and German art had to be introduced. And some of the art dealers in New York who were dealing with Klee's artwork, they were buying at this auction artworks and brought them to New York, and they were sold to museums in New York. So some of the highlight artworks that have been in German art museums are now in the museums in the US. By the end of the 1930s, Klee had like every year one or two exhibitions in New York. But it was difficult to sell his work because he did not belong to a school. You can't label Klee. And I think that makes him so interesting. He was studying cubism, expressionism, constructivism, all of it. But he did something on his own, and he was not a dogmatic artist. And I think that's why he was also so interesting for the next generation of artists, mostly also in the U.S., those who saw his art. If you look at early works from Motherwell or Jackson Pollock, or many others, you can see how they were influenced not only, but also by Klee. And I think he was a good figure because he was not telling them a style, what they have to do, but more you can be figurative, you can be abstract, you can mix it. It's this openness that he was also trying to teach. You can see it in his artworks. He always says, the artwork is not finished when I have done it. It's never finished, because everybody who looks at my artwork, it's like a post-creation. Nachschöpfung. Then, unfortunately, he got sick. 1935, they thought it's a cold. They didn't really know what it is. 1936, he was really weak. He made only few works. We know it because he was meticulously writing every year, every work he made, give to each work a number, title. So there were only, I think, 25. Yeah, really few works. But then he got better and he was producing so much from 1937 to 1940 when he died. So it was a kind of up and down with his health. Mm-hmm. They did not know what it is. Now we know it was sclerodermia. Mm-hmm. It's an illness that makes your organs stiff. Like late photographs of him, his face is kind of like a mask, but it's also the inner organ gets stiff, and nowadays you can cure it, but at that time they didn't really know how to cure it. So he died in 1940 when he was 60 years old.
What's so fascinating about Paul Klee that there are so many people still, well, coming not only to the Zentrum Paul Klee, but whenever there's a Paul Klee exhibition mm-hmm. anywhere in the world, it's like an audience magnet. Mm. Why is that, do you think?
It's because his artworks are very intimate and everybody can see something or relate to it with his or her own experience. They are quite open and you can't really grasp him that well as other artists. That makes it sometimes also difficult because people like labels. So to explain them that Klee was a very open-minded artist and was trying to do something out of what happened around him, something new, for some people it's also difficult to understand. I think he's not the blockbuster artist as Picasso, for instance, or a Kandinsky.
Well, he's more mythical, maybe.
Yes, yeah. Hmm. That has also to do with him, because he was not the outgoing guy who loved to be in front of a crowd and tell them what to do and how things are. He was rather a quiet person. So a lot of people were also considering him as... when he says something, we really all listened, because he was not talking all the time.
Are there any aspects of Klee's oeuvre that deserve a greater attention in understanding his legacy?
In general, what's important is to set Klee in a context and not show his works out of context as these dreamy, magical artworks, which a lot of people like to do, but to explain in which context did he make these artworks or that artwork, to understand that he was not the genius that did something out of nothing. That's an aspect in general that I think is really important. And his drawings, I mean, we still have drawings in our storage that have never ever been shown since he made them. There are so many drawings, but if we display a lot of drawings, people complain these are only sketches. Where are his colorful large paintings, which he did not a lot of? To understand how important the drawing was for him and how genius he was in drawing one line and what he could express with one line, to appreciate that simplicity, that reduction that he was able to do, I think that's an important point. Also in his painting, you almost always see a line. It's only during the Bauhaus period with the watercolors we talked about where the line is kind of disappearing a little bit.
So an exhibition of those drawings, that would be your dream exhibition?
Yes, but I can't do it. People will complain so much.
Do you have a favorite painting or drawing by Klee that you could describe a little bit more in detail and say why?
I will show it to you. So this is a drawing from 1939. That was the year before he died. In this year, he made 1,253 artworks in 1 year. And there are, I mean, a lot of these absolutely great drawings, very simple pencil drawings. And it's called A Dialogue Three Men. And you see a figure lying on the floor like sunbathing, and a tree that is bending down to him so that they can have a dialogue together. And I think it's such a beautiful drawing, and it makes you think about nowadays even more than at that time, the dialogue with nature that we humans should have, maybe on a same level, a little bit more intensely. And it makes you think about many aspects that are still relevant today, I think.
Most of Paul Klee's estate was donated by Livia Klee to the city of Bern on the condition that they would build a museum for it until 2005. Livia was the second wife of Paul Klee's son Felix and one of the daughters from Hannes Meyer's first marriage to Natalie Herkat. Bern had no money, though, to finance such a museum. In 1998, then, Maurice Edmund Müller, an inventor of hip replacements and successful entrepreneur, offered to pay for the Klee Museum, but wanted to decide which architect would build it and where. And so the Zentrum Paul Klee is today situated rather on the outskirts of Bern, with a beautiful view of the mountains. A light-flooded landscape sculpture by Renzo Piano, who also built the Centre Pompidou in Paris, the Foundation Bayerler, or the Whitney Museum of American Art. Zentrum Paul Klee also has a concert hall and a rich educational program. So the educational work of Klee and his deep interest in music are still part of his estate. Apart from here, Paul Klee's artwork is spread across the world. There are substantial collections at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, the MoMA in New York, the Centre Pompidou in Paris and also in Germany, at the Berggruen Museum in Berlin, the Pinakothek der Moderne and at the Lehnbach Haus, both in Munich. I hope you liked today's episode of Bauhaus Faces about this great artist Paul Klee. Thank you, Fabienne Engelhofer, for having me at Zentrum Paul Klee and for sharing your insights with us. I'm especially intrigued by Klee's attachment to music throughout his whole life. You can find musical hints in some of his paintings and drawings, like Departure of the Ships. There is a certain movement and rhythm in them. After his death, musicians even turned some of his art pieces into music. If you're interested in this topic, you should definitely go and listen to the podcast Paul Klee's Playlist. So far, there are 8 episodes about the role of music in Klee's paintings and teaching, his private music taste and record collection, and of Klee as a music critic. I will link the podcast in the show notes for you. You shouldn't miss it. I, for my part, will never be not excited to see art by Paul Klee. His work is so multifaceted, sometimes colorful, sometimes created with one single line. Thank you for listening to this new episode of Bauhaus Faces. I hope you liked it. Please don't forget to help me spread the word and tell everyone you might think be interested in this podcast. Please subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or YouTube and give me a 5-star rating or thumbs up. This helps so much in becoming increasingly visible. Help me grow our community. I appreciate your help and every single one of you. And now, there's nothing left to say but tune in next time for a new episode of Bauhaus Faces.